Hello, you're very welcome to Long Reads, a Jacobin podcast where we look in depth at political topics and thinkers. My name is Daniel Finn. Yeah. I'm the features editor here at Jacobin, and I'll be presenting the show. JBS Haldane was one of the great scientific minds of the 20th century. He played an important role in the development of genetics and the theory of evolution. Haldane was also a tireless political campaigner who gravitated towards the communist movement in the 1930s and 40s. His public career makes for a fascinating case study on the relationship between politics and science. Our guest today is Samant Subramanian. He's a journalist from India who's now based in London and the author of several books. His biography of Haldane, A Dominant Character, was published in 2019. Before going into the details of his life, could you give people who might not be familiar at all with JBS Haldane a brief summary of the position that he occupied in British public life during the middle part of the last century and some of the contributions that he made to the development of science?
Well, Haldane was primarily a geneticist, and his career overlapped with the rise of genetics as a field of study in the first half of the 20th century. He demonstrated a bunch of things. He demonstrated the mechanism of genetic linkage in mammals. So that's the way in which two genes that lie next to each other on a chromosome tend also to be inherited together. He mapped the genes for hemophilia and color blindness. He introduced a theory for how life began on Earth. His most important contribution, I think, was to reconcile two aspects of genetics that in the early part of the 20th century seemed to be irreconcilable. And if that gap had persisted, or when the gap was persisting, people really sort of were afraid that Darwin's theory of natural selection was doomed altogether. But I think more than anything else, I mean, when we talk about his stature and his role in public life, he became as famous as Einstein was in Britain at the time. And this came about primarily because of his double duties as a writer and speaker. So as a writer, he would publish opinion pieces. He wrote about his life, about his experiences in the First and Second World Wars. As a speaker, he gave talks. Hundreds of people would turn up to hear him speak. And he wasn't even a particularly magnetic speaker. But he did have the quality of simplifying science in a way that people understood it without necessarily dumbing it down and stripping it of nuance altogether. Arthur C. Clarke called JBS the most brilliant scientific popularizer of his generation. And if you go into the Haldane archives, you'll see all these documents, you'll see hundreds of letters from just regular people with scientific questions, and he would try to answer them. You'll see newspaper clippings in which the press has sought him out for comment on some aspect of science or economics or government policy. He was a sturdy sort of pillar of the left in Britain at the time, and for a while he was a card-carrying communist, to the extent that MI5 kept a file on him for the better part of two decades. So all of this added up to the kind of public profile that I think was not just that of a scientist, but was also that of a political thinker or a public intellectual, something that happens less often these days.
Haldane came from a privileged background, but it also seems to have been a background where it was considered normal to have quite a well-developed social conscience and a concern for the working class. So perhaps his later turn towards radical left-wing politics and eventually towards communism wasn't quite as much of a departure as it would have been for many other people from a similar class background in the early 20th century.
I think that's right. I mean, in a lot of this, I would attribute to his father, to J.S. Haldane, who was also a scientist. J.S. Haldane studied respiration. So he was a professor of physiology at Oxford, and he seemed to, right from the beginning of his own career as a scientist, J.S. seemed to be the kind of man who thought science should improve the lot of people out there in the world, that it shouldn't just be confined to an ivory tower or to academic journals, but the purpose of doing science was really to improve the conditions of regular people. So in his studies on respiration, for example, he then used those same principles to study why miners, coal miners, were dying underground, or to study how being on ships for extended lengths of time affected people, or how divers, military divers, naval divers, could rise from the depths safely without succumbing to the bends. He would go into slums in Dundee and try to look at the air mixture in these tenements and see if it was sensible for people to breathe and to live there. All of this scientific activism, if you will, was informed, first of all, by like a really robust background and schooling in the sciences, and that was something that JBS had as well. But it was also informed by experiments, and J.S. Haldane would experiment on himself quite often. He would go out into the field, into mines and into slums, and kind of try to see what the effect of the air there was on himself. And, you know, very famously, he took his young son, JBS, along on some of these experimental field trips while he was just a boy. There's a passage in the book where they all go down into a mine and JBS is asked to stand up straight and recite the funeral oration from Julius Caesar. And he stands up, he's a little boy then, so his head sort of barely grazes the ceiling, and he starts speaking. And because the poisonous gases that knock people out in these mines, because those are risen to the top, he starts to feel woozy and has to sit back down. So all of these experiences really, I think, instilled in JBS a couple of principles. One is, of course, the joy and surprise of doing science, of doing robust science, but then also the way in which scientists and anyone really could and should have a social conscience and to worry about what the working classes of the world, how they could benefit from the kind of science that he and his father ended up doing.
How did his experience as a soldier in the First World War and then the time that he spent in British-ruled India affect Haldane's worldview?
Well, I think he went to the First World War still carrying scars from having been at Eton, the famous public school in Britain, famously for snobs and the children of snobs, for people from the upper classes. And JBS went there sort of in his early, just past the age of 10. And he was a shy boy. He was picked upon quite frequently. He witnessed this huge degree of class snobbery around him in the school. And then he went to Oxford to get a degree, but then he went to the trenches. And the trenches were a relatively democratic space, at least as he saw it. I mean, several of the well-born and the wealthy had been commissioned as officers. That's true. And they supervised many men from the working classes, just as they did back home. But in the trenches, the hierarchies became those of rank, not of social class. So if you were a private with a public school education, you didn't get any special treatment. You didn't get any undue privileges. Or at least this was how he saw it. And in any case, when you're sort of all sitting around in a cramped trench or you're undergoing fire from the enemy, it's really difficult to hold on to these distinctions of class. And for the first time, I think JBS found himself to be popular, to enjoy a kind of camaraderie that he hadn't until then. And I think that never left him. And I think it even informed his views of the irrelevance of class distinctions that he was to carry for the rest of his life.
The comedy series Blackadder Goes Forth is still one of the best satirical representations of World War I. This scene parodies the experience of social mixing between the British working class, middle class, and upper class in the trenches.
General Melton will be here at any moment. When he arrives, leave the talking to me, all right? I like to keep an informal trench, as you know, but today you must only speak with my express permission. Is that clear? Is that clear? Permission to speak.
Yes, yes, sir.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Attention! Dug out! Attention!
Excellent. At ease. Now then, Blackadder, where would you like me to sit? I thought just a simple trim of the moustache today, nothing drastic.
No, sir. We hear about the paintings.
Oh, yes, of course. Good Lord, George! How are you, my boy? I said, how are you?
Permission to speak.
Oh, no, absolutely, top hulls are with a ying and a yang and a yippity-doo. Splendid! And your Uncle Betty sends his regards. I told them you could have a week off in April. Don't want you missing the boat race, do we?
Permission to speak?
Oh, certainly not. Permission to sing boisterously, sir.
If you must.
Row, row, row your punt gently down the stream. Belts off, trousers down, isn't life a scream?
Fabulous. University education, you can't beat it.
Bravo. Now, what have we here? Name?
Permission to speak?
Baldrake, sir.
Oh, tally-ho, yibbity-dap and zing-zang spillet. Looking forward to bullying off for the final chucker?
Permission to speak? Answer the general, Baldrake.
I can't answer him, sir. I don't know what he's talking about.
Are you looking forward to the big push?
No, sir, I'm absolutely terrified.
The healthy humour of the honest Tommy. Don't worry, my boy. If you should falter, remember that Captain Darling and I are behind you.
About 35 miles behind you.
And then he went to India, where he was on sick leave, and he spent a considerable amount of time there. I think he came back from there with a sense of the vanity and the purposelessness of the imperial project. He said at some point to his mother in a letter that he couldn't see how long this could possibly continue. And he saw the unfairness of it, of a handful of Englishmen ruling a country as vast as India. So I think these two things he brought back from the First World War with him, and they never left him after that.
Haldane's route towards becoming a professional scientist seems hard to conceive of nowadays. He studied classics at Oxford rather than any scientific subject, and indeed, he never completed a science degree before going on to work in the field.
That's right, and it was something that happened back then, although maybe now that I think about it, JBS's generation was perhaps the last of the non-specialists. I can't think of scientists who have come after that who specialized in a particular field and weren't schooled in one of the sciences, at least, if not in that field itself. So certainly there was maybe a kind of Victorian hangover of the gentleman scientists that persisted into the 20th century when JBS was at university. You know, his father was a trained scientist, but there were many other people in that era who were amateurs. I mean, these were men, invariably, of privilege and wealth, who were able to pursue scientific experiments for the love of it, and often they found out things that were useful and that aided the progress of science. JBS, of course, never studied science at university, as you mentioned, never had a science degree, but also he'd done so much as a boy. He'd helped his father. He had then started kind of working out some genetics problems on his own. His facility was with numbers was particularly great. And so I think when he came back from the First World War and got offered a position in biochemistry at Oxford, I mean, it wouldn't have been out of ordinary back then, although I think he may have been, as I said, among the last such non-specialists to have been offered such a position.
How did Haldane develop a particular interest in genetics, and how was the wider field of genetics developing at that time?
Haldane's own interest came, I think, because of experiments that he ran as a boy. His sister Naomi helped. Frequently, these were experiments with guinea pigs. The siblings kept them in hutches in their home in Oxford on the side of a path that ran to the tennis courts. And they would track how the guinea pigs reproduced, what traits they passed on, the color of their coats, for example, the length of their fur. You know, they were watching, as Gregor Mendel did, for dominant and recessive traits. I mean, which combination of parents produced what kind of traits in the children. And Mendel was the sort of the monk in, I believe now, the Czech Republic, but in the town of Brno. And he predated them by decades. But his work had only recently been rediscovered with great excitement. Mendel ran these experiments with peas in which he tracked how parents passed traits onto their children or to the offspring. And he kind of drew up a tabulated system of how that happened and what that corresponded to in terms of what we now know as genes. But the rediscovery of Mendel in the early 1900s also presented a kind of problem that was developing in genetics at the time. This was what I alluded to earlier. The people who followed Mendel and his theories, they attributed changes in a species to mutations in the genes. They could be large or small changes, but they were always what you might call discontinuous. So a guinea pig born with an extra toe, for instance, that's a discontinuous change. It's discrete. Darwinians thought that small, undetected variations would eventually accumulate over many generations in a population. Eventually, they would lead to a kind of fitness for their environment that would help the species thrive. So Darwin had famously written that nature doesn't make jumps. And the Darwinian model was something like, if you think about height in a population of people, height is a kind of continuous quantity. If you graph it in terms of how tall people are, it'll follow a natural continuous bell curve. Whereas Mendel's followers could only ever see jumps. And this gap in the theory between Mendel and Darwin, it threatened to really undo the theory of evolution and natural selection altogether. And it was at this point in the 1920s and the 1930s that Haldane, along with a couple of other scientists, essentially helped to yoke Mendel and Darwin together. I mean, they rescued Darwinian natural selection, essentially. I mean, without getting into the numbers of it, they showed through mathematics that natural selection was a really powerful force. It was capable of selecting even small genetic changes and amplifying them in a population surprisingly quickly. And to resurrect the power of natural selection was essentially to validate Darwin's theory of evolution.
The scientist John Maynard Smith followed the same path as Haldane through Eton and Cambridge and became a student of his. In the following clip, Smith talks about Haldane's contribution to genetics and also about his personal character.
The major thing that Haldane did scientifically, I suppose, has to be the work that he did, as well as it rather independently, R.A. Fisher and Sewell Wright, which was to show that genetics is compatible with Darwinism. It's very odd that in the period between 1900 and the 1920s, it really was felt that you either had to be a Mendelian geneticist or a Darwinian, and you couldn't be both, which is absurd. But I think it required the work of people like Haldane to show that that wasn't true. And it involved elegant and simple mathematical modelling, essentially. But he went on making mathematical models through his life. And I find it awfully difficult, you see, talking about Haldane, to know which of the things I think I thought of myself, which of the things I think and do I am just imitating Haldane. Because when you live with somebody of that degree of intellect, it really is hard to know what is your own ideas and what is his. But he was also a very difficult person to work with. He was one of those people who liked the feeling of adrenaline circulating, I think. He enjoyed being either angry or afraid. He admits, for example, that he genuinely enjoyed being in the trenches in the First World War because he was frightened the whole time, and somehow or other that made him feel more alive. There are people who actually enjoy adrenaline, and Haldane was one of them, but it did make him awkward to live with. It was like living with an unexploded bomb. You never knew when it was going to go off.
What position did Haldane adopt towards the idea of eugenics, which was considered to be very respectable and fashionable during the interwar period? It was by no means tainted by association with the experience of the Third Reich, as it would be at a later stage.
No, that's true. I mean, you see in both the US and the UK at the time, you see what are very definitely eugenic policies. I mean, the UK wanted to isolate the feeble-minded, as they called it. The US wanted to sterilize people deemed unfit to reproduce, and this included not just people who had physiological weaknesses, but also people of different races, of what were considered inferior races. So all of this was happening through the 1920s. And I think Haldane himself, as a very young man, you know, carried the prejudices of his class. I remember him writing about Australian Aborigines. He wrote, "I find it hard to believe that their descendants will produce a Watt or Edison." He wrote a bunch of things along these lines when he was very young. But I think as he grew older, he started to poke holes into these so-called theories of eugenics. And it happened surprisingly quickly. It happened even when he was himself in his 30s. Part of this was just the scientific invalidity of these so-called theories of eugenics. For example, scientists had actually found no way to know which human characteristics would best serve its future evolution. And scientists had found no way to selectively breed them in humans. So obviously there was a huge scientific fallacy at the heart of eugenics. Another scientific fallacy was that in the world of biology, diversity in a population is actually a good thing. It contributes to the overall fitness, overall genetic fitness of a population, because only if you have diversity can you sometimes produce traits that help the population as a whole through natural selection. Again, another sort of fallacy sitting at the heart of the theory of eugenics. Haldane, you know, the notion of race often bedeviled Haldane and other scientists as well, because in that part of the 20th century, people just struggled to understand how such visible physical differences could matter so little. But Haldane did quickly realize that people's capacities were shaped by their environment as well as their genes, and that ideas of superiority and inferiority were really quite meaningless in comparing humans. And he came to the conclusion quite quickly that the word race, as it was used then, was very imprecise. He said, quote, "The races of the past were no purer than those of today," which is something that racial perfection champions always come back to. And he eventually started, instead of the word race, he eventually started using the term population group, which is the more accurate scientific term that we continue to use today for a distinct set of people or other organisms that display similar characteristics. So that was a scientific platform on which Haldane eventually stood when it came to eugenics. But part of this was also, part of his opposition to the theory was also his developing political sense. And we'll talk about this extensively, but I think the further he went to the left politically, the more he came to realize that theories of eugenics were bound up in right-wing notions of class and of imperialism.
Even after the Second World War, some prominent figures in the US tried to promote eugenics and pseudo-scientific racism. William Shockley was a leading scientist in his own field, but he had no expertise in genetics. That didn't stop him arguing for the sterilization of black people in this 1974 interview.
"I would like to ask a question, and Dr. Shockley, if you could answer it yes or no, I would appreciate it. Do you believe that black people are inferior in intelligence because of their heredity?"
"I have a standard statement. It is not yes or no. It's memorized. I say it the same time every time, I think. What I say is this. My research leads me, and it's a tragic conclusion, really. My research leads me inescapably to the opinion that the major cause of the American Negro's intellectual and social deficits is hereditary and racially genetic in origin, and thus not remediable to a major degree by practical improvements in environment."
"All right. If you believe that the position relatively of black Americans to white Americans is based on a genetic inferiority, and I will accept the responsibility for that word, then what do you see as the solution to the problem?"
"Well, I see the first aspect of this is to prevent the problem from becoming worse by dysgenics." This first word that
Would you translate dysgenics for me and the audience? Would that be sterilization?
No. Dysgenics, you see, means what that other chart I showed you says.
Should blacks,
the least effective element.
Should blacks be sterilized?
No. I have a... this
but if
then
blacks
gets
are
into
a problem and we do not allow...
This is inhumane. And
Dr.
I think
Shockley
one can find more humane solutions to this.
Well, then how would... Then
I would propose something in which one of the key phrases is regardless of sex, race, or welfare status. you would offer a bonus to everyone to be sterilized. Now, we know we have a population explosion problem. We know that in India... that
Stephen Jay Gould used his own reputation as a biologist to campaign tirelessly against the junk science promoted by Shockley and his co-thinkers.
People talk about the fact that black people score 15 points less than white people. What do you think of this kind of numbering?
It's a fact whose meaning is totally unclear and whose existence doesn't in any sense specify the cause. Take the black-white difference in America, which is an average of 15 points, which is one standard deviation. By definition, the test is standardized so that 15 points will be a standard deviation. That's true. I mean, nobody denies that. The issue has never been that. The issue has been why. And the existence just doesn't tell you anything about why. The existence of the 15-point difference is thoroughly consistent with the two utterly extreme interpretations, namely nature and nurture. That is, in principle, it could be so. I don't think it is, that the difference is due to inborn capacities that vary between the races. And the other obvious explanation is that the difference is due to the enormous social disadvantages that the legacy and history of racism continues to impose upon the lives of black people in the United States. Either explanation would equally well account for the difference. So it is a fact whose meaning is totally unspecified by the existence of the fact itself.
Why do you think American society is so obsessed with IQ?
I don't know that we're obsessed by it, but I think it arises largely in the context of the lamentable history of our racism. I don't know that it's as much an issue in more homogeneous societies, but we have a situation based on the legacy of racism and continued oppression of people of African descent in this country that has led, for social reasons, to poor average performance of blacks on these tests. That doesn't tell you why it happens, but in a basically racist climate in a country with a strong racist history, I suppose it's not surprising that particularly conservative social thinkers would try to relate poor performance of blacks to intrinsic biological limits.
How did Haldane develop a public profile as perhaps the most famous British scientist of his age? And how did he use that profile for political advocacy in the 1930s and the 1940s?
Haldane's primary avenue to being a public intellectual was really his writing. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but it's worth emphasizing once more that anybody listening should go out and read some of what he's written. Most definitely, I think the essay I would recommend first and foremost is called On Being the Right Size. And On Being the Right Size is a sort of a great, concise marvel of the kind of writing we're talking about. It's extremely accessible. It has to do with a really fundamental notion, which is why are organisms the size they are and what impact does it have on their characteristics. Very basic, but he gets into such a wealth of detail and writes so beautifully and clearly about these notions. They're sort of uniformly accessible. And I think part of his father's idea that science should enrich the lives of common people, I think Haldane took that a step further and decided that everybody should be able to appreciate science and to understand its basics, and that really a scientifically informed society was a better society, a politically more wise society. So the writing was a large part of it. And I think the other prong to this also was the fact that a lot of his writing, if not all of it, was political in some form or the other. It might not be explicit, although it did get more explicit as the 1930s wore on and the Second World War started. But very often there was sort of a political moral at the end of every story that he told. Sometimes the connections to the science he had just discussed were tenuous. Sometimes the connections were extremely clear and explicit. And increasingly, as these ideas of eugenics, which we just talked about, as they started to swirl around public debate in the second half of the 1930s, especially as the Nazis rose to power in Germany, he was instrumental. He was such a loud voice in debunking these theories of blood that the Nazis had, and by extension, the theories of any kind of racial purity. So that was one aspect of it. But the second aspect was his willingness to take sides in the great political battle of the time, which was socialism, communism, I guess, you know, where he started off as a socialist and became a communist at some point, against the forces of fascism. And the best example of this I can give you is how he went out to Spain during the Spanish Civil War three times, hoping to help, sometimes helping, but always writing and writing for audiences back home about the things that he was seeing, the kind of dehumanization that the fascists were perpetrating on the people who he wanted to be allied with, which was the left in Spain, and the kinds of weapons that were being used, the kinds of imperialist themes to these same conflicts. All of these made it into pieces back home, and they very often ran in the Daily Worker, which was the Communist Party of Great Britain's publication. So I think using that profile for public advocacy in this particular case essentially meant urging people to think about where their loyalties lay, and to particularly urge them to shun the right in any country and to shun the Nazis in particular.
The next question that I want to ask follows on directly from what you were saying there, but perhaps you could trace in a little more detail what was the path that led Haldane towards formal membership of the British Communist Party after he had spent several years as a close sympathizer of the party, as a fellow traveler in the jargon of the time?
Well, I think, you know, we've already kind of touched a little bit upon how he grew up in a relatively egalitarian household, given the times and his background, how he sort of found the trenches in the First World War a relatively democratic space and felt a solidarity with people who were from the working classes. His wife, his first wife, had a lot to do with it. Charlotte Haldane was a communist herself. In fact, she had joined the party well before him. And she made no bones about her affiliations. And I think that influenced him tremendously. I think a trip to the Soviet Union in the late 1920s influenced him as well. This was an odd time at which he went, because some of Stalin's show trials had already started. But perhaps they hadn't been publicized quite as much to somebody who was visiting from Britain and didn't read any Russian and was kind of taken selectively to particular scientific institutions. But I think the one thing that really drew him to the Communist Party was his perception that the Soviet Union was extremely serious about the role of science in public life and in political life and in the upliftment of citizens. He went to agricultural research institutes in the Soviet Union and was just marveled at the amount of resources they had, the kinds of facilities they were given. I think he was not the only one in the British Isles at this stage who felt this way. I mean, one of his other colleagues, J.G. Bernal, once ran a comparison to see how much, as a percentage of GDP, how much the Soviet Union spent on science and how much Britain did. And it turned out the Soviet Union outspent Britain handily. And, you know, to somebody like Haldane, this was just evidence of a kind of rational form of governance in which you harness the power of science, which he obviously believed in. You harness the power of science to feed and improve the lives of the people who struggle in your country, so who struggle in poverty. And as the 1930s wore on, again, I think he, with the rise of fascism, he began to see communism as a bulwark against fascism. He wasn't the only one. And by the time the end of the 1930s came about, he traveled enough, he had written enough, he had enough of a public profile that I think the Communist Party of Great Britain felt that he would be a great catch. And he, frankly, thought that it would be an act of solidarity against the fascist forces to publicly align himself with the communists.
Latest city to fall victim to the menace of the skies was Barcelona. Out of the blue came the humming of General Franco's bombers.
When he traveled to Spain during the Civil War, Haldane saw the destruction caused by aerial bombing at first hand. This newsreel from 1938 described the impact of a raid by Franco's air force on the people of Barcelona.
It was a double raid. Only 40 bombs were dropped, yet hundreds were killed and scores of buildings were blown into unimaginable wreckage. Yet even from this appalling evil, there is hope that good may come. The British government heads an international attempt to end for all time this aerial massacre of women and children in open towns. The Spanish government appealed for a truce in these attacks on civilians. This was the insurgents' apparent reply, a rude shock to those who had hoped that humanity might prevail.
After returning to Britain, Haldane campaigned to improve the quality of bomb shelters in the event of war. The British government largely ignored his advice because they considered it too expensive. This report by the US journalist Edward Murrow gave his audience a flavour of the blitz that was endured by the people of London in 1940.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance. One single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. I can see just straight away in front of me Lord Nelson on top of that big column. There's another searchlight just square behind Nelson's statue. I'll just let you listen to the traffic and the sound of the siren for a moment. Just a few people here walking rather hurriedly toward the air raid shelters. Some of them casually. A man stops in front of me to light a cigarette. Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner. Double-deckers they are. Just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness, it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the portholes. There goes another bus. More searchlights come into action. You see them reach straight up into the sky, and occasionally they catch a cloud and seem to splash on the bottom of it. The little traffic lights here, just a small cross on the normal globe, are now red. The cars pull up and stop. I'll just ooze down in the darkness here along these steps and see if I can pick up the sound of people's feet as they walk along. One of the strangest sounds one can hear in London these days, or rather these dark nights, just the sound of footsteps walking along the street, like ghosts shod with steel shoes.
Did Haldane have his own perspective on the relationship between Marxism and science and on the philosophy of dialectical materialism that the Soviet Union promoted, which was meant to apply not merely to the history of capitalism or the history of human societies, but really to the whole history of nature and the universe?
It's difficult to tell at a remove how seriously he took dialectical materialism. There's an anecdote that I have in the book where he was once sent a really beautiful new calendar as a gift, and he wrote back to the sender saying, "I have only one possible serious criticism of the calendar. It seems a pity to have to tear out the pages of such a beautiful and instructive production. However, I expect this criticism is undialectical." And it's impossible to tell if he was joking or not. I think he did persuade himself that dialectical materialism explained the known universe relatively well. And he spoke about the subject quite often. In fact, he published an essay in 1937 called A Dialectical Account of Evolution, in which he, which is really sort of a strained essay in which he has all these torsions of interpretation to conclude that natural selection falls into the triad of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, which is the great dialectical, the triad. Of course, he, you know, these categories felt artificially neat, even to him. He may have felt at some point that he was turning this entire structure of dialectical materialism to a convenient pigeonhole just for cherry-picked facts. But I think at the core, he never leaned on these principles to do what you and I might call, or what he would call, real science. I think the real science was always kept distinct from these essays that he wrote that were almost purely a political exercise, an exercise in sort of spreading the Marxist way of thinking, in popularizing Marxism as a philosophy. And I think he was investigating some of this stuff for himself, and whether he found it entirely satisfactory, we won't ever know. But we definitely do know that in all of his rigorous scientific published papers, there's no mention of dialectical materialism at all.
For the best part of 2 years, the British Communist Party opposed the war effort during the period of the Hitler-Stalin Pact. Haldane was the chair of the editorial board for the communist newspaper, the Daily Worker. The paper was eventually banned at the start of 1941. After the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union, the party line was transformed overnight, much to the relief of Haldane and many other British communists. In 1942, the communist leader Harry Pollitt gave a speech calling for a second front to be opened in the struggle against Hitler.
There is a growing resentment in the minds of the working people of Britain against all this talk of Hitler's gigantic spring offensive, and no talk of any offensive that we intend to carry out. As a matter of fact, sometimes we are consoling ourselves by hoping that when Hitler lets go this next time against the Red Army will be able to stick it. There is never any suggestion that we are going to let go against Hitler in Europe. Unless we do, then we should not whine or beat our breasts in the future, because history will demand of us a greater sacrifice for the delay in organizing the Second Front than what it would take if it were organized now.
Haldane ultimately had to respond to the ideas of Trofim Lysenko about evolution and genetics. First of all, can you give people a brief introduction to who Lysenko was, the arguments that he made about biology, and the fate of his scientific opponents in the Soviet Union? And secondly, how did Haldane respond to Lysenko as he came under pressure from the British communist leaders to endorse his ideas?
Lysenko was a Soviet agronomist. He became one of Stalin's favorite scientists and was eventually appointed president of the Lenin All-Union Academy of Agricultural Sciences. And his interpretation of biology and genetics ran completely counter to everything that Western scientists or scientists before him anywhere in the world had discovered or proved. Lysenko felt, for example, that the way the genes behaved, they were not random, they were not abstract, they were not, they didn't happen, but genes didn't change by accident. The body in which the gene is carried has an influence upon the gene itself. And so, for example, if you change the environment around an organism like a stalk of wheat, you will change the genes in it and make it perhaps hardier or perhaps more productive for the second generation of wheat. To quote, he said, "We cannot wait for favors from nature, we must wrest them from her." And this seems to be very much of a piece with the Soviet philosophy of sort of taming the natural world to get as much from it as possible to, in order then, improve the lot of the working classes.
Oh, Stalin was a mighty man, and a mighty man was he. He led the Soviet people on the road to victory. All through the revolution, he fought at Lenin's side, and they made a combination till the day that Lenin died.
In the early 1950s, the Scottish folk singer Ewan McCall recorded this song in praise of Stalin. The second half of the song expresses the idea of the Soviet Union triumphing over barriers imposed by nature, as well as man-made social structures.
Then Stalin went into the north and there saw rivers three, all emptying their waters into the polar sea. Now that's not right, Joe Stalin said, these rivers, they're ours. We'll turn them round and make them work and make electric power. There was a range of mountains that were standing in the way. So Stalin put his hand out and smoothed them all away. For Joe, he is determined to make the land all green, and that's the biggest project that the world has ever seen. Oh, Stalin is a mighty man, and he has a mighty plan. He's harnessed nature to the plow to work for the good of man. He's hammered out the future, the forgeman he has been, and he's made the worker state the best the world has ever seen.
Lysenko sometimes even directly contradicted the kinds of things that Haldane had worked on or that Haldane had stood for. He completely rubbished the idea that arithmetic or mathematics or statistics could tell you anything about the way the genes behaved. And this was exactly what Haldane worked on almost all his life. And anybody in the Soviet Union itself who disagreed with him was eventually ostracized, or worse, in the case of Haldane's acquaintance, Vavilov. Vavilov was sent off to a prison to eventually die. Several other people were kicked out of the academic sciences in the Soviet Union. Other people disappeared. And in parallel, all of these disastrous agricultural experiments that ran in the Soviet Union based on Lysenko's advice and suggestions, they all failed spectacularly. And, you know, you have to remember that a lot of this is happening in the 1940s, by which time Stalinism is well and truly entrenched. People are sent to the gulags or to Siberia quite often. And so Lysenko created this climate of fear in the Soviet sciences in which no one would be willing to speak out against his extremely erroneous theories. Again, that is something that went completely against Haldane's grain, because if he championed anything in the sciences, it was the ability to speak the truth about what you find and about what you think, and to approach science with the so-called scientific temper, cold, hard, rational look at facts without any fear of political prejudice.
You suggest in the book that Haldane was reluctant to face the truth about Lysenko and the way that his critics had been repressed because of the wider implications that it would have in terms of how the Soviet system worked. When he did move away from the Communist Party in the wake of the Lysenko controversy, did Haldane change his broader perspective on the Soviet Union under Stalin's rule, whether in public or in private?
There has been for decades a real kind of bewilderment about the way Haldane responded to Lysenko, particularly because on the BBC, famously in 1947 or 48, I believe, he went on the radio and took on three of his colleagues and attempted to defend the undefendable, attempted to defend Lysenko's theories of science. And to anyone who only had access to that kind of information, it would seem as if Haldane had either subscribed to Lysenko wholesale, which seems ridiculous, or had sort of given in to the pressures of the Communist Party to defend Lysenko. The truth is actually sort of more complex, and a lot of the archival material that I found kind of speaks to this. I mean, Haldane, I think, chose to make that broadcast, chose for a few months or a matter of a year or two to defend Lysenko in print and on radio, because he felt that it was an important moment in the history of communism, and that by rejecting Lysenko, he would do the party more harm than good. And he decided that he would lend his stature to buttressing Lysenko's reputation and his theories for the greater cause, you might say. But, you know, in the background, I mean, he was writing to his colleagues in the Communist Party of Great Britain all the time, arguing that the party had to distance itself from Lysenko. He had furious arguments with people in the party on this.
Haldane's student John Maynard Smith also joined the Communist Party and remained a member until 1956. Speaking with Richard Dawkins in 1997, he discussed the Lysenko affair and Haldane's relationship with the movement.
I tend to think his thoughts were very similar to my own, and the difficulties he went through were very similar to my own. But there was an important difference. He was a very public figure. We were in the middle of the Cold War. He was very reluctant to say anything which would be used in the Cold War as a sort of anti-Soviet, pro-American propaganda. And he was therefore saying quite different things inside the Communist Party about Lysenko to what he was saying in public. I mean, I heard him talk at a number of inner party meetings in which he was saying to the communists essentially two things. First, you know, it is not right that politicians should tell scientists how to do their science, which is what the Executive Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union had in fact done that scientific questions have to be settled by scientists and not by politicians. And secondly, that it is not right that scientists who don't agree with the party line should be put in prison. And he was very explicit about that within the party, trying to persuade people. And the third thing he was saying is it is not necessary or desirable that the British Communist Party should have a policy supporting Lysenko. And he was very clear about that within the party. Those were not the things he was saying in public, outside the party. And I do understand why. You know, and indeed, I think he may be quite right to divide the things he said in public. The one other thing I remember vividly, and I wish I knew more, in a way, this would have been, I guess, in very soon after I graduated, in about 51 or 52. The Russians sent to Western Europe a hatchet man of Lysenko's called Gluschenko, who called, among other people, on Holden to... He arrived with a couple of goons. It was awful, you know. He arrived in the department, and he and the goons, I can't remember, I think and the goons, were actually closeted in Holden's office for about 3 hours, trying to persuade Holden how right Lysenko was. And Holden was absolutely unapproachable for 2 or 3 days afterwards. He was clearly pretty shaken by what I take to be Gluschenko's ignorance. I don't blame myself at all for joining the Communist Party in 1938. I think I'd do the same again. I do blame myself for staying in as long as I did. Mm-hmm. And therefore, to some extent, I must be critical of Holden for staying in as long as he did.
After the Lysenko episode, the reason that he distanced himself from the party itself, he moved away from the party, was in part because he had burned so many of these bridges. He was quite upset with the way in which his colleagues in the Communist Party of Great Britain refused to stand by him or refused to sort of think like rational scientists, which was his model of thinking. And I think he did change his broader perspective on how the Soviet Union worked as well. But there's no evidence of him rethinking Stalin in private. I didn't find anything in letters or diaries that indicated that he had changed his mind about Stalin himself. Somewhat disgracefully, I think, like towards the end of his life, somebody did ask Holden about Stalin and about what he thought of him. And I'm quoting, he said, "I thought and think that he was a very great man and who did a very good job. And as I did not denounce him then, I am not going to do so now." You know, I struggled for a long time to make sense of this and to figure out if it was just sort of a one last show of public loyalty towards the communist or the socialist or the left, to the cause of the left, or whether it was just a stubbornness and an unwillingness to indicate that he had made a mistake when he judged Stalin's Soviet Union. You know, by the time he said this, details of Stalin's massacres and starvations and penal colonies were extremely well known. And yet it just seemed like he wanted to keep ammunition out of the hands of the Soviet Union's critics. So that was sort of his, you know, maybe the last thing he ever said or wrote about Stalin. But I think the disillusionment with the Soviet Union did set in. And one result of that was actually his move to India towards in the final phase of his life. We do know that he quit the Communist Party of Great Britain at some point after the Lysenko affair. We don't know exactly when. And he himself refused to confirm it to reporters who asked him about it. But I think it's definitely clear that he was sort of disillusioned with how the party had behaved around Lysenko, and perhaps he felt that he couldn't continue to be a public figure in British life and continue to speak up for the party and the cause. But there were other reasons also. I mean, University College London, which is where he was a professor at the time, was in quite straitened circumstances following the end of the Second World War. Some of their buildings had been demolished. They had few resources. I mean, so few resources that Holden himself had to buy teaspoons for the canteen or for the staff room where his lab was based. And I think the offer that came from India, from a university in India, promised the kind of resources and students and pace of work that he was really seeking now that he was quite old. His own finances here in Britain were in quite straitened circumstances as well. He was paying alimony. He was often in the red. I mean, his bank statements are still in the National Archives, and so you can look them up and see that he was in the red, you know, month after month, quite often because he was actually paying for lab equipment and other other expenses related to work out of his own pocket rather than having the university funded because the university just wasn't able to. So these were reasons as well. He'd gotten married a second time and the university in India offered Helen a position there as well, which was something that he wanted. And he had been to India before. I think he liked it. He liked Nehru, who was the Prime Minister of India at the time. And I think maybe politically, India offered a kind of alternative socialist model to the Soviet Union, a model in which the country was democratic, but there was a very strong welfare state. Nehru himself was a huge advocate of science and technology and its role in public life, and that was something that Haldane always championed. I think politically he was extremely attracted to the Nehruvian idea of India, and it must have been a sort of welcome relief from having to just defend the Stalinist ideal of the Soviet Union.
After relocating to India, Haldane delivered a lecture in 1957 on the question of unity and diversity in nature. The lecture was in honour of Sardar Patel, a leader of the Indian National Congress during the struggle against British colonial rule. Haldane referred to Lenin when speaking about the role of conflict and contradiction in the natural world.
One of the most striking discoveries of physiology is the way in which antagonistic processes achieve a regulation which apparently cannot be achieved in any other way. What happens, for example, when you straighten your arm which was previously bent at the elbow? The muscles in the upper arm above the elbow, such as the triceps, become shorter and thicker, as you can easily feel. At the same time, the stronger muscles which bend the elbow, such as the biceps, relax. But they do not relax completely. If they did, you might straighten your arm so violently as to dislocate your elbow. In fact, both sets of muscles are pulling to some extent. And the same is true all over your body. This keeps you in a steady posture, but uses up a good deal of energy. If the muscles relaxed completely, you would need appreciably less food. This apparently wasteful antagonism, or struggle of opposites, is entirely characteristic of the bodies of higher animals. At every level, stability is achieved by conflict of this kind. Such a system is far more elastic against external influences than such a rigid system as most man-made machines. A good deal of what we take to be evil in human societies and in the universe is one side of such a conflict. We human beings are seldom wise enough to see that the conflict is part of a large-scale pattern. Lenin, in particular, stressed the necessity of conflict for progress.
You mention in the final pages of the book a conference at the NASA headquarters in the US that Haldane attended and chaired towards the end of his life. Carl Sagan, who was surely the best known scientific popularizer in the US, if not the whole world, during the late 20th century, was also in attendance at that conference. He also mentioned a meeting that Haldane had in the US with Richard Lewontin, the biologist who was a collaborator with Stephen Jay Gould. Did figures like Sagan and Gould take Haldane as a conscious model to emulate in writing about science for a general audience, as well as in drawing connections between science and politics?
I'm not sure that they consciously looked to Haldane, or at least I found no evidence until now that that's what they did. And they were extremely popular, extremely lucid writers about science for the general public. But I think the uniqueness of Haldane really lay in his willingness to stake out a political position nearly every time he wrote about science. I've read a lot of Stephen Jay Gould, and of course, you could make the argument that all science, all writing on anything is politics, and therefore there's politics implicit in every piece of work that you do. But I think what Haldane did that I think maybe Carl Sagan and Stephen Jay Gould didn't is relate science or anything else he was writing about really directly to the political issues of his age and often to the political parties of his age. It's a kind of extremely partisan, but in a good way, writing that we expect of political scientists today, maybe, but not of biologists or physicists or chemists. And I think that culture faded as the 20th century progressed. You know, C.P. Snow wrote about this most famously, where he wrote about how the sciences and the humanities or the liberal arts seem to be exist in different worlds altogether, not speaking to each other. And I think this had a lot to do with that.
You finish the book with some reflections on the political implications of science and what scientists today could learn from Haldane. Perhaps that might also be a good point on which to round out the interview.
Well, I think, it's difficult to generalize because it's a different time. So, you know, one of the things I was thinking about was how Haldane's academic background as a non-scientist, by which I mean that he didn't formally study science at university, he studied, you know, classics, how that helped him be a broader human being, a broader writer, where he could combine science with ideas about how society works and how politics works, and could really become the kind of person that he was. Whereas scientists today start specializing from very early in their lives, in their careers. There are children in high school who start interning with scientists for the eventual career that they want, you know, 15 years later once they've finished their PhDs. So specialization sets in much earlier these days. But of course, that is a symptom of just how science has developed, that there's so much more to master in a particular field that you need to start studying it earlier in order to then be able to make meaningful contributions. So it's not that scientists today can look at Haldane's life and aspire to mimic all parts of it and end up like Haldane. I mean, some of the exigencies of modern science in the modern era just definitely do play upon them. But having said that, I mean, there are a couple of ways I kept thinking about when I was writing my epilogue, because it was around the time that Donald Trump had been elected in the US. It was around the time the March for Science was starting to take off in cities around the world, really. And I remember thinking to myself that it was a shining moment for scientists raising a public voice in a way that had happened only sporadically earlier. I mean, it had happened maybe with climate change, for example, of James Hansen being an extremely loud and vociferous voice when arguing about the dangers of climate change. But it hadn't happened in the realm of politics that confronts everyday life and everyday society. And I think Haldane made it a specialization of his own to speak to exactly those situations. And the second thing, I guess, which is allied, is Haldane and his father's sort of insistence that science shouldn't transpire entirely in labs, in ivory towers, or in academic journals. I mean, their insistence that scientists and science should reach out to everyday people to try to communicate, at the very least, important science in easy terms, but then also to try to constantly think about how science could relate to the problems of the working classes and to the problems of a nation's society. That is allied to, I guess, this thing I talked about earlier about raising your voice in a political space. So these two things do go hand in hand. And I think what Haldane realized is that science doesn't exist in a vacuum, that science is infinitely impacted by politics, and so therefore science should push back against politics as well.
Many thanks to Samantha Romanian for that introduction to the life of J.B.S. Haldane. His book, A Dominant Character, The Radical Science and Restless Politics of J.B.S. Haldane, is available from Atlantic Books.